Some retailers have developed a cult following, and if you're a fan of Publix, Wawa, or the Dorothy Lane Market, boy, have we got a podcast episode for you. In other news, voters may have approved the $1.6 billion sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway to Norfolk Southern, but that sale is off to a fumbled start. This is Above the Fold. Welcome to Above the Fold, a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, where we bring you some of the biggest stories of the week and interviews with the people behind the news. I'm your host, Andy Brownfield, joined by co-host and editor-in-chief, Tom Demaropoulos. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Andy. Happy to be here.
So a bit of housekeeping before we get started. This is going to be our last episode for 2 weeks. We're going to take a break because of the Thanksgiving holiday, so there will be no episode on November 27th, but we will be returning to you on December 4th. So speaking of Thanksgiving, Tom, are you the primary cook for the Demaropoulos family's Thanksgiving dinner?
I am. So I will be doing the turkey, and I make a roasted potato and parsnip soup.
Ooh.
And I will be making roasted Brussels sprouts, a green bean casserole, because you have to have green bean casserole in the Midwest.
It's traditional.
I make my own gravy, and then I'll be baking. I'm trying to convince my kids to bake two pies with me. We're definitely going to do an apple pie, but I've never made a pecan pie, so I want to make a pecan pie or pecan pie.
My mom makes one of those every year for Thanksgiving, and it's the highlight of the meal, along with my dad's stuffing. You know, from that, you can probably glean that my parents, they are the ones who've long hosted dinner for as long as I remember. I've never had to cook a turkey, and to tell you the truth, it kind of intimidates me. I mean, how do you do yours?
So I get mine spatchcocked, which means that the backbone is kind of removed, so you can cook the turkey flat. So it cooks way faster than if it was the whole bird, which makes for a much easier day, so you're not like up early taking care of the bird. It cooks probably in about 90 minutes, 90 to maybe 2 hours, which is much faster than a typical turkey.
Yeah, I've seen people deep fry their turkeys, which looks dangerous and scary.
Yes, my brother, who lives down in Houston, deep fries his turkey, and he's never had an issue with it. But yes, it is like you're wearing these giant gloves like up to your elbow to make sure the grease splatters don't get on you when you drop it in.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be trying that. Not that I have the opportunity. So, Tom, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fierce loyalty some of these retail brands inspire in their shoppers. I mean, our own Chris Wederick, he wrote 5 things about this last week and how he spent a week in Florida and how much he enjoyed shopping at Publix while he was there. I mean, the only brand loyalty I ever had were Camel cigarettes, and I haven't smoked in 6 years.
Camel Lights?
Yeah, I was Camel Lights and then Turkish Silvers because they were just so light and airy. It was almost insubstantial. I mean, that was my gateway cigarettes.
Not Turkish Golds?
Not Turkish Golds.
Yeah. So I'm with Chris, though. So I'm the primary grocery shopper at my house. I do 98% of the grocery shopping. So I enjoy a good grocery shopping experience. And when I go on vacation, a lot of times to Florida or to South Carolina, going to Publix is part of that experience, because it's or Harris Teeter, because I love the Harris Teeter stores down in Hilton Head as well. But yeah, there's something to be said about Publix.
Yeah, so the Florida-based grocer just signed his first lease in the region, and it's set to open up in 2025 in Northern Kentucky, and it's going to be at the intersection of Triple Crown Boulevard and Richwood Road in unincorporated Boone County. It's going to have a Publix liquor center adjacent to the supermarket. So I know Publix, like a lot of big retailers, Costco is the same way. They will refuse to confirm or deny any new locations until a lease has been signed and they are ready to announce. But it's rumored that they're actively pursuing multiple additional locations in Northern Kentucky, which kind of makes sense because they got a few around the Louisville, Lexington area.
Yeah, so retailers like this don't open one store. If they're going to come into a market, they're going to come into the market. So that means multiple locations. So I'm sure they are looking to see where they can find the best spots, the best real estate to enter into the market and build out. So that way it makes sense to have a distribution center in Kentucky to, you know, bring your fresh groceries up there. This is probably the first of a couple, at least.
Yeah, and it's kind of their first beachhead into rival Kroger's backyard. I mean, Publix is a key competitor to Kroger in the Southeast, and it's one of the nation's 10 highest volume supermarket chains and largest employee-owned company in the U.S. But they're still kind of dwarfed by Kroger's sheer size. I mean, they've got about 1,300 stores compared to Kroger's 2,700, which is set to nearly double if this merger with Albertsons goes through.
Yeah, that is one thing that Kroger would definitely still have size on Publix, but as I said, it's a really pleasant shopping experience.
Well, next up, we've got Dorothy Lane Market. And Tom, you've got some experience with Dorothy Lane, right? I mean, you were not living in, but working in Dayton for a while.
Yes, I worked in Dayton for about 2.5 years and got to know Dorothy Lane Market with, you know, the original store and then their newer stores that that had opened in the Dayton region. And this is a foodie's grocery store. Like, if you love food, walking through a Dorothy Lane Market is... you're like a kid in a candy store. It's just such an experience. And the thing that always impressed me the most about Dorothy Lane is how knowledgeable and friendly their staff was. These are people who know food. Like, if you want to know about cheeses, they will tell you all about the cheeses they carry. If you want to know about fresh produce, they'll tell you all about it. Wine, prepared foods. It's a phenomenal place to stop in.
So they're opening the first Cincinnati area store in Mason. It's also their first store outside of Dayton. It's going to be at the intersection of Mason Montgomery Road and Western Row Road. And, you know, that might be worth a trip out. I already routinely make the trip out to Mason to get Marion's Pizza, Dayton-style pizza, and maybe I can combine that with a trip to Dorothy Lane. So this store is going to be 50,000 square feet in the main level with a 9,000 square foot mezzanine, which will include an on-site culinary center.
Ooh,
sounds pretty snazzy.
Oh, yes.
And this is going to anchor a $150 million mixed-use project by Traditions Building and Development Group and Western Row Land Developers on 70 acres. So it's pretty big plans there.
Absolutely. And Andy, Dorothy Lane, I don't know if this is fair to say, but they're one of those retailers that developers are so interested to bring to their projects. And for so long, Dorothy Lane has been like, no, we're just, we're happy where we are. We're happy with our three stores. The fact that they're coming to Mason is big. It's really big that Traditions was able to work with them to get them to be part of this development. And it's going to be just a regional draw for that project.
And now finally, we've got news on Wawa's expansion into the Cincinnati market. This might not be the same as a Publix or a Dorothy Lane, but it's still got its own cult following. And this is actually a story from our newest reporter, Christian LeDuc, our man on the restaurant, retail, and healthcare beats. Wawa is a Pennsylvania-based convenience store / gas station / fast casual food chain, and it's planning nearly 20 locations through the Cincinnati region. Sidebar, it's a road trip tradition in the Brownfield-McCartney household to stop by a gas station and get gas station nachos, which is a recipe for botulism because it's like the kind of nachos where you open the bag of chips and they've got little areas that you can spoon jalapenos and fresh vegetables, and then you can push a button on a machine and it'll squirt out meat sauce and nacho cheese, which, damn if it isn't good, but probably really, really bad for you. But this is a little bit different than what Wawa offers.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with Wawa. I've never been to one. But apparently they have this strong cult following. I don't know what to liken it to. I guess it's kind of like the way we here in Cincinnati feel about UDF, where people will be like, you get your milkshakes from a gas station? Like, hell yeah, we get our milkshakes from the gas station. They're fantastic.
Yeah, and Wawa, I mean, I guess the closest thing I can liken it to is a gas station that's got a partnership with a Subway or something, but it's really more than that because they offer a full menu of things like fresh-made pizzas, hamburgers, breakfast sandwiches, quesadillas, salads, hoagies, even smoothies and milkshakes, so it's all done in-house. It's not like that gas station partnership, so it's a really upscale experience for your road tripping. Honestly, sounds much better than my nachos. So I know that felt like it was three separate retail stories, but we're counting them as one so we can keep with the conceit of covering five things in this podcast, much like our daily five things columns that go out with our morning edition email. So we're going to call this story number two. The sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway to Norfolk Southern was only just approved on November 7th, but it's already hitting a speed bump.
Yeah, Andy, not what you want to see if you were on the pro. What, really, not what you want to see on, if you were on either side of this issue.
Yeah, so the way this was supposed to work was that the railroad buys the railway from the city, and then Cincinnati goes and invests that $1.6 billion and uses a portion of the annual investment proceeds to address more than $400 million in deferred maintenance for things like roads and firehouses and city facilities. And that investment money's got to be managed by someone, right?
It does.
So the Cincinnati Southern Railway Board is supposed to select that manager. But a fumble by the city manager's office has delayed that process. So the board is its own governmental body, but it's using the city's procurement system to solicit proposals from would-be fund managers. And the city manager's office handles that, but the board has to sign off on everything. So a, quote, junior staff member in the city manager's office extended the deadline for companies that want to manage that investment to apply, but they didn't get sign off by the board. So that led to the deadline being extended, but then rescinded, and two would-be applicants missed their chance to submit.
Yeah, Andy, again, as I said, kind of not what you want to see when this was kind of a contentious issue that went to the voters, and it's not like there was it passed, but it wasn't like there was an overwhelming, there wasn't like the support was so high that it was like, oh, obviously this is going to happen. And then to have miscommunication just doesn't feel great.
No, and the Railway Board last week passed a number of motions to kind of rectify this situation, and it's going to give those two companies, and specifically just those two companies that were intending on applying but delay their applications believing that they would have extra time, a chance to complete their applications. And it's going to bring the number of companies vying to manage this $1.6 billion fund to 18. And, you know, this wasn't without some consternation at the board's latest meeting. Charlie Lucan, former Cincinnati mayor and a member of the Cincinnati Southern Railway Board, said, quote, "I just want to underscore this is a board process, a board procurement, and I hope it's respected. I don't feel that way right now. It doesn't feel like it's been a board process right now." So we have found our way back to my favorite topic to talk about on this podcast.
Sports!
Yep, specifically college athletics. So, Northern Kentucky University, which is in the midst of a budget deficit that its new president is trying to address, is going to add six new varsity sports programs in an attempt to bring in more students who will ostensibly pay tuition, which will ostensibly help address that budget gap. Is this kind of like a couple who are on the verge of breaking up having a kid in an attempt to stay together? Is that unfair of me to say?
I don't think that's fair, Andy. You know, so we've talked about in the past with Xavier University looking at bringing back football. Athletics is a huge part of the college experience, you know, for good or for bad. I think that part of that, like, I think you look at UC's success, and you can attribute some of that to what they've done on the football field is a reason for people to be excited about going there. It's as, you know, silly as that may sound when you're talking about getting your engineering degree or becoming a pharmacist. You know, having a winning football team is something that makes a school attractive. It's a fun atmosphere. It makes it for a fun campus. So I think these additional sports at NKU have the ability to bring in people who otherwise might not have looked at NKU.
Yeah, so these new sports are women's stunt, which, what is that?
Andy, stunt is an all-female cheerleading discipline that emphasizes the acrobatics and kind of takes out the cheerleading aspect of the competition.
So it kind of sportifies it.
Yes.
So they're adding that, along with men's and women's swimming, men's and women's triathlon, and men's volleyball. And not only that, but they're expanding the rosters of four sports and spirit programs: men's and women's track and field, cheerleading, dance, and pep band. So these actions are going to double the number of student athletes that can attend NKU, and it's going to cost about $1.4 million annually. But these aren't scholarship athletes, so that would, you know, up the roster of full tuition-paying students at NKU. And like you said, I mean, hopefully it'll generate excitement from people who are interested in these sports and want to attend a university where that's a thing. So you mentioned football at Xavier. Alas, that is not coming to NKU. President Katie Short Thompson, who's brand new as of September, said that it's going to take a $200 million donor to get that off the ground, and she doesn't see it happening in her tenure. This all comes against a backdrop of NKU beginning the 2022-23 school year, believing that it had a deficit of $5.5 million. But new chief financial officer August Alltop, who has since departed, discovered an additional gap of $18.7 million, bringing the total deficit to $22.4 million. And by September of this year, that deficit had shrunk to $13.4 million, but it led to layoffs of about 100 faculty and 25 staff, with more to come. But so far, NKU's been mum on those numbers. Tom, speaking of college, we were in college a few years apart, and I'm curious, when you wanted to class it up a little bit, sip on a nicer beer, what would you buy?
So when I wanted to, so I, my initial like better beer of choice would have been Guinness. I was a big Guinness drinker. And then I moved to, Newcastle.
Solid.
And then, Stella, I guess would be my fancy light beer of choice. And then oh, what the hell was the other one? Can't think of it.
Well, I thought I was living the high life, not when drinking Miller High Life, but if I bought a 12-pack of Killian's Irish Red or Rolling Rock. That was some good beer to someone who's used to drinking natural light. I mean, heck, even Bud Light was a step above what they were pouring at many frat parties. But somewhere around, I think, my junior or senior year, about when I became legal drinking age, I'm not sure if it's a coincidence or not, I started seeing more and more of what we now call craft beer popping up. I mean, I went to college in Athens, Ohio, so down the street from my apartment was Jackie O's, and then every time I'd come home to Cincinnati, I'd bring back a sample pack of Christian Moreline or Mount Carmel. And when I came back to Cincinnati to work for the Courier, I feel like that's when craft beer really started taking off. I came back in 2013, and that was around the time you had breweries like Rheingeist, Mad Tree, and Braxton taking off. Well, one of those early craft breweries, one of the first in Over the Rhine, has now closed.
Yes. Sad news for Taft's Brewing Company as they are closing kind of that original, that flagship location there at 1429 Race Street. Which, Andy, I don't know. So for me, this is a project that I followed and reported on kind of from the beginning back when the city was going to demolish the building that Taft's was located in. Like they had, I think they had even bid out the demolition package. They were like going to tear down this building, and 3CDC and Steve Leeper kind of came in and said, hold on, give us the money that you had set aside for knocking this down. We'll stabilize it and we'll figure out what to do with this building, which is kind of a great thing that's that 3CDC has been able to do in Over the Rhine with lots of buildings, but this one in particular is just gorgeous.
Yeah, it went into the former St. Paul's Church in Over the Rhine, and it had been planned since 2013 and opened on Red's opening day in 2015. It had the craft brewery, but also a meat-focused menu of barbecue, and they're famous for their tri-tip steak. But apparently that wasn't enough for them. They created this umbrella company, Taft's Brewing Company, and they opened up the Brewporium in Spring Grove Village and a second Brewporium in Columbus. And those are both staying, doing fine, doing well, remaining open. But the original alehouse is closing on November 25th. And this move comes after FC Cincinnati decided to close its sports betting site on the lower level of Taft's Alehouse. And as we talked about on last week's podcast, that site itself was never all that successful, with more than 90% of the betting activity coming from its associated app.
Yeah, I just, I don't know what the... I'm not the demographic. Obviously, we've talked about this, that I'm not a sports gambler. I'm very risk-averse. But I just can't imagine there's a lot of interest in in-person sports betting, like going to a place to place a sports bet when it's so easy to open up your phone and do the betting on an app.
Yeah, I don't know how much business that brought to Taft's, but clearly it wasn't enough, which kind of raises the question, with everything going on in Over the Rhine, is this closure something that should concern people? Because Taft's had kind of the recipe for success. They had a restaurant, they had a lot of space that they were able to bring people into. And they had a beverage program built in with their brewery. So what do you think? I mean, is this a sign of things to come?
I don't know, Andy. That's a good question. It's interesting to me that the brewporiums are staying open. So I wonder if they're seeing more success there. And I don't know if it's getting crowded in over the Rhine in terms of options, or if this location has just kind of run its course.
Yeah. You know, through November of this year, we've seen more restaurants close across Cincinnati than we saw in all of 2020. And that was really among the worst of the crackdown on public living through the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's clearly a tough time out there for restaurants. So speaking of closures, I know we usually try to end the podcast on a lighter note with a fun story, but we're just going to bring you down with another story of a downtown institution closing its doors for good. Tom, do you have a lot of memories of Hathaway's Diner?
Not a lot of memories, a few. I have been there a few times. It was a really – so I'm a fan of kind of the – you might call it a greasy spoon type diners. I enjoy going to those types of places, the places you see on like diners, drive-ins, and dives. I like those types of restaurants that have that character, that authenticity that you can kind of feel when you walk in the door versus and nothing against chain places, but I just have a soft spot in my heart for those types of locations.
Yeah, you know, I've got some fond memories of Hathaway's. I remember my dad, who worked downtown in the Mercantile Library building, he took me there a couple times, and then I even got breakfast there with Rob Dahlmeyer, our former editor, now a VP with our parent company. You know, one of the times I was visiting Cincinnati in between reporting gigs. But, you know, after nearly 70 years, Hathaway's announced that it had closed in the Crew Tower. And owner Danny Holbrook blamed that on things like the presence of food trucks across the street in Fountain Square and just the plethora of new restaurants that had opened downtown. And while that is true, I mean, especially in places like the Foundry across the street from Carew Tower, there has been on Fountain Square itself, there's been a resurgence of new restaurants opening, with Jeff Ruby's Steakhouse moving down there and March 1st Brewing opening up a restaurant inside of the former Rock Bottom Brewery space. The Thunderdome Restaurant Group is going to open up a more fine dining place in the former Royce location, and they opened up City Bird right there on Fountain Square. So there is a proliferation of new options for people, and there has not been the return to public life downtown since the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, Andy. As you look at downtown, and really Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday feel pretty normal, but 3 days is not enough to be a successful business. That's not enough people to carry you through on those other days. So Monday and Friday still don't feel like Monday and Friday used to. The weekends, I'm not down here as often, so I'm not sure how busy it feels on those types of days. But you can't run a business on 3 out of 7 days a week being your opportunities to make money.
No, and just like with office, when you see companies coming back to the office, there's been what we've called the flight to quality. I feel like the same is true for restaurants. When new restaurants are opening, you're seeing more boutique-type places, places with a higher price point, places where you might not eat every day or even every week, but when you do, you're going to be spending a higher ticket price. And it might have made it harder for a place like Hathaway's, where A, you're not getting the daily diner crowd who's going to breakfast before heading to the office, and B, when people are downtown once, twice, three times a week, they're going to some place that's a little more upscale, a little pricier, like Maplewood. So it's, you know, it was a tough go for Hathaway's, and unfortunately it's really a bummer to see an institution that's lasted nearly 7 decades having to close its doors.
Definitely.
So this week on the podcast, we've got Chad Munitz, Chief Development Officer with FC Cincinnati. Chad wasn't a big soccer fan before joining the team, but he did geek out about real estate. His career spans stints as the Economic Development Director of the City of Cincinnati, Executive Vice President with 3CDC, and VP with Town Properties. And when Cincinnati's Major League Soccer team needed someone to focus full-time on real estate as it embarked on a massive $300 million mixed-use project surrounding its West End home in TQL Stadium, they turned to Chad. He talked with us about what's planned for that project and how it will reshape that urban neighborhood. This is Chad Munitz on Above the Fold. So now, are your... Forgive my ignorance. Are your offices based out of TQL Stadium?
They're not.
Oh, that would be a pretty cool place to work day to day.
I'm there a lot, and in Milford, in our soccer training facility.
Which is a really... I had never driven past there until recently. I was out at the Cincinnati Nature Center and went past the training complex to get there. And that is a really impressive building as well.
Thanks. Yeah, it's nice. We just finished an expansion there, too. So
what was the expansion for?
Really two things. We're running out of space. When we built the training center, we've always and will continue to have enormous growth expectations. You know, we've got enormous appetite to be bigger and better. And our academy, which is the young boys, the 13 to 19 year olds, has grown quite a bit. And so the coaching staff and technical staff has grown. And then we have a second team, which hopefully you know, but there's a what we call FCC2. So the whole league has a second team. It's kind of like Triple A baseball is the easiest way, but probably at the level of soccer in America, it's probably Double A baseball is kind of that level. But it's like the farm system. And we didn't think we were going to have that, and the league wasn't going to grow that and for a couple of years. And 2 years ago, they're like, nope, you got to have a team ready this year. So we were really getting tight on space. And because of that, a conference room that we used to do film study in for the first team got used up by people. And then, you know, the growth of our communications and marketing group that Kelly leads up out there, the things that we need to produce just to be a great professional, you know, sports entertainment business, but also the demands that Apple TV has for us. We've grown that, so we're just out of space. So we built new kind of office space and workstations for the technical staff, but then also built a proper film room. So it's that, you know, theater style kind of film room that you've probably seen with mostly pro football teams. Yep. But so there's a small version of that. So that was the addition.
Nice.
So
sorry, are we actually going? Or?
Oh yeah.
So all right. Sorry.
always be recording.
So I'll be a little more succinct when I.
Oh no, it was perfect.
Just rambling.
Yeah. So I'm curious about a number of things, and just forgive me. I know very very little about sports. My parents made me play t-ball, soccer, basketball. I think that's it. Growing up, and I was horrible at all of them. But that the second team, is that are they branded differently from FC Cincinnati? Do they play? Are they currently playing?
They are. So we've had our second full season of them playing. They are currently branded FCC2. I think you'll see that we'll try to figure out a little better branding of them in the coming months. They play the majority of their home matches at NKU Soccer Stadium, and we've got had a great relationship with NKU. They've got actually one of the nicer soccer facilities probably in all Division I soccer around the country. We've played a couple games each season at TQL just to kind of give that experience to not only the players but also to some of the fans to come out and see the match at TQL. But they play a full travel schedule against all the other, you know, second division teams from MLS. So the league is actually branded MLS Next Pro. And so there's there will be 30 teams once San Diego starts in the next pro of the MLS kind of second division, but they are adding independent teams also. So I think the league would like to grow, maybe eventually to double the amount of teams and really have this kind of nationwide network of the second division of soccer that's under MLS. They are all pro athletes, under a contract for us. And we have brought people up and down similar to baseball of where we'll have players, you know, start there. And even last year, our really star goalie from most of last season and this season, Roman, has started at the second team player. And then because of injuries, got called up and have played. And then also bringing folks down when they're injured, you know, just like Joey Votto went down to Louisville and played a little bit to rehab starts to get back. And then I don't know if you've ever seen at the end of a soccer match, some of the players that don't get enough time still have to condition. So we also sometimes send folks down if there's a game that next Sunday after a Saturday match to get some more conditioning in.
And then the academy, is that talent development or is that more community outreach?
No, it is talent development.
Really?
I think everything we do is community outreach, and that really backs into what we're about as a club and an enterprise is really community first. That's why we started. And I think if you look at what we've done and how we go about our day-to-day business, and really our fan base started because we love the community and people love Cincinnati. It's probably at the beginning, more people said, I love Cincinnati, therefore I love FC Cincinnati, than I love soccer and I love FC Cincinnati. Now I think we've got a great mix of both. But it's a developmental group. So there's almost 150 boys that are part of the academy.
Wow.
So most pro soccer teams have academies, and this is very common in, you know, South America and Europe, where it's the starting kind of feeder into that. Out of our youth boys, the vast majority of them are from greater Cincinnati, but we do have some that come in and stay with host families. And, you know, we get them into schooling and try to develop them into either professional athletes in our, or really get them into college. You know, our goal is these are hopefully some of the better soccer players around. And I think all their goals is to become a professional athlete, but that's not possible for everybody. And so we do a nice job of keeping up with them, making sure they're getting their schooling done, making sure that, you know, things are good with that, and try to get them into college. So if they're not going to continue to play professional sports, coming from the amateur of the academy, that they can continue their education and hopefully get a free education by getting a scholarship to play soccer.
I was going to ask, is soccer kind of different? We're asking you a lot of soccer questions as the real estate guy for FC Cincinnati. And maybe we'll move over to real estate as well.
That's the fun part of the job.
Is the farm system different for soccer because there aren't as many men's soccer programs at the college level anymore?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's just that is kind of how youth soccer has grown internationally and then really developed in this country. You know, it started of when I was growing up in, you know, rural Eastern Ohio, the soccer wasn't even an option for me to play when I was young. It was, you know, played football, basketball, and baseball, and that was it. I don't think we even had youth soccer until I was in high school, and then they started youth soccer programs. But because of the youth soccer programs and starting that young, it's a sport that, you know, anybody can play at a youth age. It's a sport that boys and girls can play together, and then men and women can play together. It's just and it doesn't cost a lot to get into it. So there's very low thresholds for anybody to participate in the sport. So that, I think, just drives a lot of the talent pool into it, and hasn't been as much of losing things at that level. And then really just feeding into this huge international soccer culture and society of that's how people move around. And, you know, folks that are good at their sport, at any sport, I think always want to try to make a living out of it. And so tying into that international aspect of soccer is helpful and important and kind of feeds into that. And, you know, we're not there yet in America and MLS of being in the top, 10 leagues in the world, but we are quickly approaching that. You'll see year after year, you know, there are great strides this year and just growth with our national broadcast partnership with Apple, growth of bringing Lionel Messi into the league, that you'll just quickly see us continue to grow and, you know, eke our way up into hopefully the top five leagues in the world in terms of talent that we bring. We'll have World Cup in the United States, Canada, and Mexico in 2026. So it'll be a big year to drive attention in the States to soccer.
Yeah, I promise we're going to get to real estate questions soon, but were you always interested in soccer, or did it come with the job?
No, it came with the job. I mean, I think I started, as I kind of talked about, how most Cincinnatians at the very beginning, I love Cincinnati. I'm a homer for it. This is actually, in October, was my 20th year of being in Cincinnati. So I still call New Philadelphia my home, where I grew up in Eastern Ohio, but I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else in my life now, being here 20 years. So I was a fan of the city. I'm a homer for the city of Cincinnati and the region. And so I was a passive fan, gone to maybe a dozen matches through its career, and really got a call somewhat out of the blue from Jeff Birding, who I knew socially. I wasn't, you know, day-to-day buddies with them. We didn't hang out. When I worked for the city of Cincinnati, Jeff was on council for a number of years then. And he called me up and said, we need somebody to wake up every day and think about real estate. We've, you know, we've really, and he'll, it's not shy of saying this. We were building the plane while it was flying, trying to get the club going. And they were very successful of doing that. So, but we've got great ambitions. We needed to focus on this mixed use next to the stadium, focus on expanding the training center, just to have all the things that we do, and wanted someone to wake up in-house doing that day-to-day. And I get to do that and be part of a professional soccer team, being in pro sports. So that was pretty interesting. But really what drew me to want to say yes and make a change out of the blue was the values that Jeff has and that our ownership has, really starting with that. We care about the city. We care about doing things right. We want to be here long term. This isn't a quick money-making turn to do stuff, even on the real estate. This is all about giving back to the city and making sure that we improve the city and it's better than it was when we started. And kind of having those values was pretty exciting, and being with a group that had that at the forefront of being purposeful about how we go about doing everything was pretty exciting to get to do development, be part of pro sports, and you know, hopefully do some stuff that I'm have had some time to figure out and do well in terms of urban redevelopment work.
Yeah, so for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you kind of give a overview of this massive $300 million development that the team is planning around TQL Stadium in the West End?
Yeah, so let me step back a bit. You know, when we moved from the United States Soccer League into Major League Soccer and wanted to build our own soccer-specific stadium, we looked at urban sites, Oakley and the Ovation site, and then the site in the West End, and you know, ended up deciding on the most urban site out of all of those. And we always had thought about doing a community around the stadium. Mm-hmm. That this was, and getting back to, it was always more than just building a place for our team to play. It was making a difference in the community that we went into. And part of that is help developing a district that flows out and makes the community better that we're part of. And it's pretty exciting because the West End has lots of opportunity to do that. And unfortunately, gosh, over the last 75 years has not had great investment, and people have turned their back on them and done things that have really harmed the residents and the people that have lived there. And so being able to be a part of that and create a district next to our stadium that helps and gives back. So when we acquired property for the stadium, we ended up having about 8.5 acres of additional land north of the stadium. So it's all north of the stadium, south of Liberty Street. And then the east and the west are John Street and Central Parkway. So we own almost all of that and want to do a fairly large-scale mixed-use development at that site. It is interesting because it's in the West End, but just right across the street from Over the Rhine. Mm-hmm. So Over the Rhine, as you know, is, gosh, I don't know what the exact figure is, $1 billion of investment probably over the last two decades. And it's just really a world-class neighborhood. The West End hasn't had that, but also we've got some great advantages of being in the West End, not over the Rhine, where we can build new, we can build modern, we can build tall. So over the Rhine, and it's really why it was so successful, is has all these wonderful historic buildings, but has very restrictive rules and regulations in terms of what you can do and build and rehab, and we don't have that in the West End. Mm-hmm. So our $300 million-ish first phase of this development will include buildings that are very tall. You know, right now the hotel is 19 stories tall. The apartment, so we were looking at a hotel apartment building, which is 13, 14 stories tall, an office building that's probably 6 stories tall. So hotel, office, apartments, we're looking to do some sort of entertainment complex, probably a concert venue, but also maybe a movie theater as part of that to draw people there. Lots of ground floor active commercial space, and then a public plaza that would really tie it all together. But we would like it to be very kind of modern and forward-looking. We're really happy and proud of how the stadium turned out and how it looks, and the neighborhood has been also. And so working with the neighborhood, that's really what they've come back to, is go big, do something interesting and tall.
Yeah, and so I'm very curious about the music venue, or I know it's a possibility, but how did that need come to you guys? How did that make itself apparent? And then what do you see that filling? What kind of niche? Because you've got the Brady and then the MegaCorp Pavilion across the river. You've got Bogart's. I'm pointing towards Norwood, but it's over there. What kind of niche do you see that filling in the West End?
So it really started with placemaking, and let me back up again also on that. We're going to have beautiful buildings, and it's going to look really nice, but the success of this over the long term is how people interact with the space. So where your feet are to maybe 20 feet above, that is the day-to-day success in the long term of a district putting that together. So having great ground presence, having great public space, and then actively programming that space is important. And so while we'll have, gosh, we're going to have probably close to when we play an MLS Cup this year, which will be December 9th if we make the championship game, and we're confident we're going to, that'll be probably 35 games, I think, that we'll have in the stadium, so 35 full bowl events in the stadium. There's another 330 days a year that we want active programming to happen in the district, and so figuring out a way to continue to draw things into the district. And so started talking about what are those entertainment venues that would help draw people. And I've talked to professionals and doing some research. There is a miss in our market for this 1,500 capacity venue. So the things on both sides of the river are much larger than that. There are some good facilities that are a little smaller than that. But if you look at kind of what goes around the country in terms of both musical and comedy and event tours, the missing mark in Cincinnati is about 1,500 capacity venue. It makes it a nice capacity size also, because then you can really flip it and do lots of different events. So 1,500 still is small enough and intimate enough to do private events, parties, corporate events, trainings, group outings, and still have those concerts. When you get to some of the larger ones, it gets tough to do it. The smaller ones work well also for doing some of those private events. So we think we can have pretty comfortably another 200 events a year that would drive, you know, in that 1,200 to 1,500 people event a year. And then, bring in a small boutique movie theater too would also every night drive people to the district. So that, and then the day-to-day program that we do in the kind of public plaza part of it, it's going to be important to the overall health.
I was going to say, Chad, how important is the success of that development? How important is bringing people in, not just from the neighborhood and over the Rhine, but people from the region to come and visit on a regular basis? Is that a key part of it, or is it more building density and capturing those people who are within, you know, downtown, the basin?
It's all of it. You will need to bring people from out of the basin there, but we started with the West End and the West End community and the residents there, of talking about what's their aspirations, what do they want, what don't they want. We've had dozens and dozens of community meetings and input before we even got the crayons out and started drawing of what they want. And it's their neighborhood, and we wanted to make sure we understood what their wants are and not force something that, yes, this can drive lots of suburbanites in, but I think we're going to end up with something that, what I like to say, welcomes all and includes all. And so that's been a big thing. You know, the three main items that the community has always talked about really align with kind of our vision, which is one, go big. That's the one thing that they have always said when we go talk to them. The other one is be inclusive, and that's something that's personally important to me. It's important to Jeff and Carl and the ownership group, and we're going to do the right thing from both the group that we put together to help us do this, the contractors that will be building it, the laborers there, and then the businesses and the people that are employed there. And the last is we want the best in our neighborhood, and so we were purposeful when we started some of those community outreach. You know, you put the pretty pictures up and put stickers of what you like and don't like, the green dots and the red dots, and wanted to kind of test of, hey, if something is a couple blocks south or north or east or west of where their residence is, do they want it duplicated there? And they were really adamant that we do. We want a water feature for kids to play in. We want to have farmers markets, maybe not every day, but, you know, Findlay Market's just two blocks away from the site. But they're like, this should be in our neighborhood, and we deserve nice things. And we haven't had those in a long time. And so those are really the three main components that we continue to hear from the residents of go big, be inclusive, and give us the best of everything.
And so I know work's already started on this, but when can people begin to expect to see some of this come online?
Our goal is to have things online during 2026, so kind of first quarter 2026, and so summer of 2026 when World Cup is in the United States, you know, things would be open and ribbons would be cut and you could start using it. I will tell you, financing is becoming more difficult day to day. You two know very well from your jobs of being kind of the business paper of record in town. You know, we've got a great group of sponsors and ownership group, and I think we're going to thread the needle and figure this out. But the probably even more than just higher interest rates, the volatility that people, just this unknown of what is to come, is making everyone uneasy. But we're pushing forward and trying to figure that out. We do have a large request into the state with their TMUD program, which is their transformational mixed use development, that should get awarded before the end of this calendar year. If we get that, I think we'll be in good shape. If we do not get that award, I'm a little leery of making those deadlines, but I'm confident enough that we'll figure out how to piece this together and keep things moving. The biggest part of it that I don't know that you'll see day one is office. While we have an enormous demand for office, it is becoming very difficult to finance, especially here in Cincinnati.
I think that's everywhere. Not everywhere, but there are many markets that are struggling with lenders being willing to say, yes, we'll lend on that.
We will be in a position probably to have signed leases with credit tenants and still probably not be able to lend on it. And it's not to get too into the weeds of how the lending works, but even a long-term office lease is 10 years and most of the lenders want to see really what's going to happen in years 11, 12, 13, 14, because that's when that next cycle of refinancing would occur. And so it's what stresses them out. And, you know, to preach a little bit about my view of just the region is we just need to continue to grow. It's my biggest fear of what's happening here compared to other areas around the country. And even in Ohio with us competing with Columbus, we're just not growing at the same pace. And not just the city, this is the whole region needs to look at this. As credit markets get tighter, as banks get more conservative, they're making choices and their choices to be more lenient to get deals done or looking at areas that they see are growing, and we're not growing as quick as other regions that they're looking at. So we got to figure out how to be pro-growth all around and not be afraid of it. I frequently look at your sister publication in Columbus, and there are a lot more headlines of new groundbreakings, new projects getting announced in the Columbus region than here. And we got to figure out how to reverse that. No offense to Columbus. They can continue to grow. So not reverse them not growing and us growing, but we need to grow a lot more in this region to support all this.
Chad, thank you so much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Above the Fold is a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, hosted by me, Andy Brownfield, and Tom Demaropoulos. The podcast is produced and edited by me, and our theme music was written by Dylan McCartney. Come back next week for another edition of Above the Fold.